That's okay with you. You're not thinking. His own daughter. He's done, Ethan said. Finished. But he has information we're going to need. Go mobilize your men. Send a team to shut the gate and restore power to the fence. I'll go to Pilcher. You will. Ethan stood. That's right. Alan dug his keycard out of his pocket, dropped it on the floor, and said, You'll need this. A key fell beside the card. That, too. It's for the elevator. And while you're at it... He pulled a subcompact Glock out of a shoulder holster, held it by the barrel, and offered Ethan the gun. As Ethan took it, Alan said, If the next time I see you, you confess that, in the heat of the moment, you put a round into that piece of shit's gut and watched as he bled out slowly, I will totally understand. I'm sorry about Alyssa. Alan left the room. Ethan bent down, lifted the key and the plastic card off the floor. The corridor was empty. Halfway down the stairwell, he heard it, a noise he knew all too well from his time at war. They were firing the chain gun, and it sounded like death on the drums. By the time he reached level one, the noise was unreal. People would be leaving their workstations, leaving their residences. At the pair of unmarked doors, he swiped the card through the reader. The doors opened. He stepped into the small elevator car, pushed the key into the lock and the control panel, and turned it. The single button started blinking. He pressed it, the doors closed, and the racket of the chain gun began to gradually fade away. He took a deep breath and thought of his family, his fear for them blooming in his stomach like a flower of broken glass. The doors opened. He stepped off into Pilcher's suite. Passing the kitchen, he heard the sizzle of meat cooking, garlic, onions, olive oil perfuming the air. Chef Tim obliviously at work while the Abbeys invaded, intently plating Pilcher's breakfast, adding intricate dots of a bright red sauce from a pastry bag on a piece of china. As Ethan moved down the hall toward Pilcher's office, he checked the load on Alan's Glock, happy to see a round already in the tube. He opened the doors to Pilcher's office without bothering to knock and strode inside. Pilcher sat on one of the leather sofas that faced the wall of monitors, feet propped up on an acacia wood coffee table, a remote control in one hand, a bottle of something old and brown in the other. The left side of the wall showed feeds from Wayward Pines. The right, surveillance from inside the superstructure. Ethan walked over to the sofa, took a seat beside him. He could break Pilcher's neck, beat him to death, suffocate him. The only thing stopping him, really, was the sense that this man's death belonged mostly to the people of Wayward Pines. He couldn't steal that away from them. Not after everything Pilcher had put them through. Pilcher looked over, his face streaked with deep scratch marks that still oozed blood. "Who'd you tangle with?" Ethan asked. "I had to let Ted go this morning." Ethan bristled. Pilcher smelled boozy. He wore a black satin robe and looked disheveled as hell as he offered Ethan the bottle. "No thanks." On one of the screens, Ethan saw the brilliant muzzle flash of the chain gun cutting down Abbeys in the tunnel. On another, Abbeys on Main Street, lackadaisically feeding on kills from the night before, their stomachs bulging. "Quite an end to it all," Pilcher said. "Nothing's ending but you." "I don't blame you," Pilcher said.
"Blame me? For what?"
"Your envy."
"What exactly do you think I envy?"
"Me, of course. The way it feels to sit behind that desk, to have created all of this."
"You think that's all this is about? That I want your job?"
"I know you believe in your heart it's about giving people truth and freedom, but the truth, Ethan, is there is nothing in this world like power. The power to kill. To spare." He waved at the screens. "To control lives. To make them better. Or worse. If there ever was a god, I think I know how he must have felt. People demanding answers they could never handle.
people hating him, even as they basked in the safety he provided. I think I finally understand why God went away and left the world to destroy itself. Pilcher smiled. And you will too one day, Ethan, after you've sat behind that desk for a while. You'll understand that the people in that valley aren't like you and me. They can't handle what you told them last night. You'll see. Maybe. Maybe not. Either way, they deserved to know the truth. I'm not saying it was perfect, or even fair, but before you came, Ethan, it worked. I protected these people, and they lived the closest thing to normal lives that they could ever hope for. I gave them a beautiful town, and the opportunity to have faith that all was as it should be. Pilcher drank straight from the bottle. Your fatal flaw, Ethan, is that you're under the mistaken impression that people are like you. That they have your courage, your fearlessness, your will. You and I are exceptions, cut from the same cloth. Even my people in the mountains struggle with the fear. But not you and me. We know the truth. We aren't afraid to look it in the eye. Only difference being, I'm aware of this fact, and it's something you're going to learn slowly and painfully, and at great cost of human life. But you'll remember this conversation one day, Ethan. You'll understand why I did the things I did. I'll never understand why you turned off the fence, why you murdered your daughter. Rule long enough, you will. I don't plan on ruling. No? Pilcher laughed. What do you think you've got down there? Plymouth Rock? You going to write a constitution? Start a democracy? The world beyond the fence is too cruel, too hostile. That town needs one strong man to lead. Why did you turn off the fence, David? The old man sipped his whiskey. Without me, this would be a world free of our species. We're here because of me, and me alone. My money, my brilliance, my vision. I gave them everything. Why did you do it? You might as well say I created them. And you. And you have the gall to ask, why? Pilcher's eyes suddenly burned with unchecked rage. Where were they when I discovered that the human genome was becoming corrupted? That humanity would become extinct in a matter of generations? When I built 1,000 suspended animation units? When I dug a tunnel into the heart of a mountain and stocked a 5 million square foot ark with enough supplies to rebuild the last town on Earth? And while we're on the topic, Ethan, where the fuck were you? Pilcher's entire body shook with fury. Were you there the day I emerged from suspended animation and took my crew outside to find that the Abbeys had taken over the world? Were you there as I walked down Main Street watching my workers frame each building, pave each road? On the morning I called the head of suspension into this office and instructed him to wake you up so you could be with your wife and son again? I gave you this life, Ethan. You and everyone in that valley. Everyone in this mountain. Why? He growled. Because I could. Because I am their fucking creator, and creations don't get to question the one who made them. Who gives them breath, and who can, at any second, snatch it all away. Ethan looked up at the monitors. They showed chaos in the cavern. The chain gun was empty, and the guards were falling back with their AR-15s as the monsters advanced. I didn't even have to let you up here. I could have locked the elevator. What are you going to do with me? Pilcher asked quietly. That's for the people you tried to murder to decide. Pilcher's eyes misted, as if for a fleeting moment he saw himself with clarity. He looked back at his desk.
at the wall of screens. His voice became raspy with emotion.
"It got away with me," he said, and then he blinked, a hardness returning to those small black eyes, like water freezing over.
Pilcher came at Ethan with a short-bladed fighting knife, a sudden, lunging stab aimed straight at Ethan's gut. Ethan deflected Pilcher's wrist, the blade only grazing his side. Rising to his feet, he rained down a savage left hook that snapped Pilcher's head around and cracked his cheekbone, the force of the blow driving him off the couch, his head smashing into the edge of the coffee table. Pilcher shivered out on his back, and the knife slipped out of his grasp, clattering to the hardwood floor.
7. Hassler, Secret Service HQ, Seattle, Washington, 1814 years ago. Hassler enters his corner office in the Columbia Center, happy to see Ethan Burke already seated across from his desk. By his watch, he's 5 minutes late. Burke probably arrived 5 minutes early, which means he's been waiting at least 10 minutes. Good.
"Sorry to keep you waiting," Hassler says as he walks past his agent.
"Not a problem.
Imagine you're wondering why I pulled you off that Everett thing."
"We're close to an arrest."
"That's good to hear. But I have something more pressing for you."
Hassler takes a seat and studies Ethan across the desk. He isn't wearing his black and whites today. His surveillance outfit is a gray jumpsuit, the shoulders still damp from the late morning drizzle. He can just see the outline on Ethan's left side of his concealed shoulder holster. It crosses Hassler's mind that he can still pull the plug on this. Until the words leave his mouth, he hasn't committed a crime. In all his years in law enforcement, interrogating criminals, he's always hearing about the nebulous line between right and wrong. They were only stealing for their family. They'd only intended to do it once, and his favorite. They didn't even realize they'd crossed a line until they were deep into enemy territory on the other side, with no hope of ever getting back. But as Hassler sits on this side of the desk, this side of the line, all that conjecture on the ambiguous nature of right and wrong feels like bullshit. He sees his choice with crystalline clarity. If he sends Ethan on this assignment, he has crossed the line forever. No coming back. If he ejects out of this entire enterprise, lets Ethan go back to his case in Everett, he stays a good guy who almost did a very bad thing. Nothing confusing here. No gray area from his perspective.
"Sir," Ethan says. Hassler pictures Teresa, a couple years back at the company picnic. Thinks of Ethan flirting with Kate while his wife cried by herself on the shore of Lake Union. Teresa's fears about Kate and Ethan were borne out last year when Kate put in an abrupt transfer request for Boise, Idaho. Ethan cheated on Teresa with his partner, and everyone knew it. He humiliated his wife, and a woman like Teresa deserves so much better.
"Adam," Ethan says. Hassler lets out a breath as rain ticks on the window behind him. He says,
"Kate Hewson is missing."
Ethan leans forward in the chair.
"For how long?"
4 days.
"She went missing on the job?"
"Her partner's missing too, guy named Evans. You and Kate had a special relationship, right?"
Ethan doesn't bite, just stares, intense.
"Well, I just figured you'd want to take on the search for your old partner."
Ethan stands.
"Boise is emailing the case file," Hassler says. "We're booking you on a flight out of SeaTac first thing. Tomorrow morning, you'll meet up with Agent Stallings in the Boise field office, and the two of you will head north to the last place anyone heard from Kate."
"Where's that?"
"Little town called Wayward Pines."
Hassler watches Ethan leave. He's done it. Set it all in motion. And the weird thing is, he doesn't feel any different. No regret, no fear, no anxiety. If there's one overriding emotion, it's relief.
Spinning around in his chair, he stares out his window at the gray, wet gloom of downtown Seattle, the water droplets beating and running down the glass. From his office on the 31st floor, he can see the building where Teresa works as a paralegal. Imagines her sitting in her lifeless cube, typing dictation. He doesn't know how exactly, but he will have her one day. He'll love her like she's meant to be loved. Somehow, and this is the biggest mystery of his entire existence, she has become the only thing that matters in his world. Flipping open his prepaid cell phone, he dials. David Pilcher answers, "Hello?" "It's me," Hassler says. "I was beginning to wonder if I'd ever hear from you again."
"He's coming to you tomorrow."
"We'll be ready." Hassler closes the cell, takes out the battery, and breaks the phone in half. He places the two pieces in the styrofoam container at the bottom of his trash can that holds the remnants of yesterday's lunch. Teresa. Teresa and Ben reached the edge of the forest as the sun dipped behind the distant peaks. She whispered to her son, "Wait here." Moving on, Teresa crawled through a grove of scrub oak, the dead leaves crunching too loudly under her knees. Where the oaks ended, she peered through the branches. They had reached the outskirts of Wayward Pines, but had somehow traversed the entire forest to the north side of town. The streets that Teresa could see appeared empty, the houses dark, and not a murmur to be heard. She glanced back at Ben, waved him over. He crawled noisily through the leaves and squatted down beside her. Putting her mouth to his ear, she whispered, "We need to travel 10 blocks.
"Where are we going?"
"Sheriff's station."
"Walk or run?"
"Run," she whispered. "But take a few breaths first. Fill those lungs up with air." She and Ben both drew in deep pulls of oxygen.
"Ready?"
she asked.
"Ready."
Teresa scrambled out of the thicket and climbed to her feet, then turned and helped Ben up off the ground. They stood in the backyard of a Victorian she recognized. She'd sold this house to a young, expecting couple 3 months ago, after their good behavior in town had been rewarded with an upgrade to a larger, nicer home. What had been their fate these last 24 hours of hell? Most front yards in Wayward Pines were enclosed by white picket fences, so she and Ben jogged up the sidewalk. The valley was going dark. Night always seemed to set in a little too quickly once the sun had gone behind the mountains, and considering there was no power in the entire valley, this would be a black evening. They were coming up on the first dead body in the street. Teresa looked back at Ben and said,
"Don't look, honey."
But she didn't take her own advice. The good news was that it had been eviscerated so completely it looked less like a human being than a pile of guts and bones. A buzzard roosted on the ribcage, glutting itself. They reached the intersection of 1st Avenue and 11th Street. Teresa could see the tall pine trees in the distance that soared out of the front lawn of the sheriff's office.
"Almost there," she said. "Block and a half to go." "I'm tired."
"I am too,
but let's finish strong."
At the intersection of 1st and 13th, Ben whispered,
"Mom?"
"What?"
"Look."
Teresa glanced back. 3 blocks down 13th Street, 2 pale forms were running on all fours in their direction.
"Sprint!"
Teresa screamed. They accelerated, a surge of adrenaline-boosting power and speed. She leapt over the curb and raced up through the trimmed grass toward the entrance to the sheriff's office. Once inside, Teresa stopped and looked back through the glass doors toward the street.
"Did they see us come in here?"
Ben asked. The first Abbey hit the intersection at full speed, and without missing a beat, altered its course, now heading straight for the sheriff's office.
"Come on!"
Teresa wheeled around and bolted through the lobby. The farther they moved away from the entrance, the darker it got. Crossing the threshold, she turned the corner into Ethan's office, saw the gun cabinet wide open, ammunition spilled across the floor, several rifles left behind on the desk. The bottom cabinets of the gun case were open too. She reached inside, pulled out a large pistol, pointed it at the wall, and squeezed the trigger. Nothing happened. The safety was on, or it wasn't loaded, or both.
"Hurry, Mom!"
She grabbed a revolver out of the case, but it was empty, and she didn't even know how to break the cylinder open to load it, assuming she could match up the right ammo. From where she crouched by the gun case, there were at least a half dozen different sizes of cartridges scattered across the floor beneath her feet.
"Mom, what are you doing?" Ben asked.
This wasn't going to work. They were out of time, and despite being married to a Secret Service agent, she didn't know the first thing about firearms.
"New plan," she said. "What?"
She jerked open Ethan's desk. It had to be there. His first week on the job, Ethan had given her a tour of this place, including locking her into the single jail cell as he swung the key on his finger by the carabiner it was attached to, smirking as he drawled, "Unless you can think of some way to bribe the sheriff, looks like you're spending a night in lockup, Mrs. Burke." She'd seen him return that key to this middle desk drawer, and now she reached all the way to the back, fingers desperately searching. There. She felt the carabiner, pulled the key out, and rushed around the desk to Ben.
"What are we doing?" he asked. "Just follow me."
They tore back down the hallway, and Abby screamed outside.
"They're here, Mom!"
As they crossed the lobby, Teresa glanced toward the entrance, saw the pair of Abbeys running up the walkway, lined with baby pine trees, seconds away from entering. She shouted,
"Faster, Ben!"
They turned down another dark hallway. At the far end, Teresa saw the black bars of Wayward Pines' only jail cell. First time she'd seen it, it had reminded her of the cells in The Andy Griffith Show. Something almost quaint about those vertical bars. The single bed and the desk inside, the kind of place where the Saturday night drunks had a standing reservation. Now, the cell looked like a life raft. The hallway opened up at the end, the fading evening light slanting in through a high window. Teresa slammed hard into the cell bars as the Abbeys crashed through the glass doors into the station. She clutched the key, worked it into the lock. Talons clicked down the dark hallway behind them. One of the Abbeys shrieked. The deadbolt turned. Teresa opened the door and screamed, "Get in!" Ben rushed into the cell as the first Abbey launched out of the corridor. She stepped in, jerked the door closed, and locked it a half a second before the Abbey rammed the bars. Ben screamed. As the first Abbey picked itself up off the floor, its partner crawled out of the hallway. It was the first time Teresa had seen an Abbey up close. The one that had crashed into the cell was huge and covered in gore. Death emanated off its blood-soaked skin. Ben's back was up against the wall, his eyes gone wide, a puddle forming under his feet.
"Can they get us in here?" he asked. "I don't think so. Are you sure?" "No."
When the second Abbey collided with the bars, the entire structure shook. Teresa wrapped her arms around Ben as the first Abbey stood to its full 5.5-foot height. It cocked its head and watched them through the bars, milky eyes blinking, processing, problem-solving.
"What's that thing moving inside its chest?" Teresa whispered. "That's its heart, Mom. How do you..."
Oh, right. He'd learned about them in school. The heart beat rapidly, blurred and distorted through the layers of skin, as if Teresa was watching it through several inches of ice. This one's legs were short, and standing straight, its arms reached all the way down to the floor. It slid its right arm between the bars, slim but rippled with muscle. It was over 4 feet long, and Teresa watched in horror as those black talons stretched across the floor of the cell.
"Get away!" she screamed.
The other Abbey came around the side of the cell and did the same. Its left arm was 5 feet long, and when one of its talons grazed Ben's shoe, Teresa stomped on its claw. The Abbey roared. Teresa pulled Ben toward the corner farthest away from the bars, where they climbed up onto the metal bed frame.
"Are we going to die, Mom?" "No."
Three new Abbeys emerged from the corridor and broke for the cell, screeching and hissing. There were more behind them, the noise in the room growing and growing. Soon, there were 15 arms reaching through the bars, and more Abbeys hurling themselves at the cell. Teresa sank down onto the bare mattress and held Ben tightly in her arms. The light coming through the window had changed from blue to purple, the room becoming steadily darker. She put her lips to Ben's ear and said over the noise of the monsters, "Think about another place, another time." Ben trembled in her arms, and still more Abby's streamed into the room. Teresa stared up at the high window as the monsters shook the bars and crashed into them and reached their hideous long arms into the cell. The last thing she saw as the light went away was the room beyond the bars, packed wall to wall with Abby's, and one of them kneeling down in front of the lock, trying to dig its talon into the keyhole. Suddenly, there was nothing to see. Night had fallen over Wayward Pines, and they were in the dark with monsters. Ethan. Ethan rode the elevator out of Pilcher's suite to the level one corridor. As the elevator opened, he could still hear gunshots, but they were distant now. He headed for the glass doors at the end of the hallway, pulling the pistol Alan had given him as he crossed through the threshold into the Ark. It looked as if most of Pilcher's inner circle had come down to see the source of all the commotion. At least 100 people were milling about, confused and scared. The gunshots were louder here, the reports issuing from somewhere deep in the tunnel that led down through the mountain into Wayward Pines. There were dead Abbeys everywhere, piles of them in the tunnel, 40 or 50 in the cavern, blood running in channels over the stone. 5 bodies, covered by sheets, lay in a row next to the entrance to suspension. The smell of spent munitions was overpowering. Alan came running out of the tunnel. Ethan pushed toward him through the crowd, saw Alan's face speckled with blood, his right arm tore open by what Ethan surmised was the slash of a talon. The racket of an AR-15 fired up in the tunnel, followed by a scream. "We're pushing them back," Alan said. "But there must have been 200 Abbeys. I've lost men. The M230's out of ammo. If we hadn't had the chain gun, this would have gone a whole lot worse. Where's Pilcher?" "He's unconscious, tied up in his office. I'll send someone down for him." Alan's radio squeaked. He answered, "Alan, over." Mustin's voice crackled through the speaker, shouting above gunfire. "We just drove the last band out of the tunnel, but the door's compromised. Over." Alan said, "I've already got a truck headed down to you, with sheets of reinforced steel and a 3-man team of metal workers. They're going to weld the door shut. Over."
"Copy that. We'll hold the line. Out."
Ethan said, "You can't seal that exit. We have to get to the people in the valley. My wife and son are down there."
"We will, but we need to regroup, reload. I lost 8 men that I know of. If we're going to roll out in force into Wayward Pines, we better take every last weapon in our arsenal. We have to find more ammo for that chain gun." His eyes became grave as he said, "And we can't go out there at night."
"What are you saying?"
"It's already evening. It'll be dark long before we're ready to go. We'll head into town at first light."
"Tomorrow? We aren't equipped to do battle at night. You think the unarmed people in that valley are? You think my wife and son?"
"We'd be slaughtered in the dark, and you know it. All that would happen is we'd lose the only chance we have of saving those people."
"God damn it.
You think I don't want to scream into town right now, guns blazing?"
Ethan moved toward the tunnel.
"Where do you think you're going?" Alan called after him.
"To find my family."
"You go out there at night. The only thing that's going to happen is you'll get eaten. There's hundreds of those things out there."
2 steps into the tunnel, Ethan stopped.
"I can only imagine how you feel," Alan said. "If it were my family out there, you wouldn't be able to hold me back. But you're smarter than I am, Ethan. And certainly you understand that your death tonight on some suicide mission isn't going to save your family or anyone else's."
"Damn." He was right. Ethan turned, blew out a hard, frustrated sigh. He said, "So the residents of Wayward Pines get to spend another night in the dark, in the cold, with no food, no water, sharing that valley with a swarm of Abbeys." Alan came toward him. Ethan could hear, far down the tunnel, more gunshots. Alan said,
"Hopefully, those who survived the initial invasion have found safe places to hole up. Where's your family?"
"I left them in a cave, behind a locked door, halfway up a mountain."
So they're safe, then?
I have no way of knowing that. There's a group in the school, Ethan said. Down in the basement. 80, 90 people.
What if we just...
Too risky, and you know it.
Ethan nodded.
What about the gate and the fence? Is it still wide open? Another 1,000 or 30,000 Abbeys could just stroll right into our valley if they wanted?
I had the lead technician look into that. He says we can't turn on the fence from inside the superstructure.
Why?
Apparently Pilcher sabotaged the internal system. Only way to power the fence back up and close the gate is through the manual override.
And let me guess.
It's at the fence. Wouldn't be fun if it were easy, right?
I say we send someone, Ethan said. Right now.
There's a secret exit on the south side of the mountain. It's only a quarter mile from there to the fence.
Send that technician and a couple of guards.
Okay, but while I do that...
Alan glanced over his shoulder at the crowd of people who had wandered into the Ark.
They don't know anything. They just heard gunshots and came down here to see what was going on.
I'll talk to them, Ethan said.
He started toward the crowd.
Alan called after him, Be gentle.
Why should I?
Because this is the only life they know, and you're getting ready to blow it all to pieces.
Teresa. She jerked awake, her eyes opening to total darkness. Ben was stirring, mumbling, No, 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 in his sleep.
She shook him awake and whispered, You're okay, buddy. Mama's got you.
It had been years since she'd uttered words like those to her son, not since she'd been a young mother, rocking her baby boy to sleep. The window cracked in his nursery, and the two of them lulled by the whisper of soft Seattle rain.
What's happening? Ben asked.
We're still in the jail cell, but we're okay.
Where are the monsters?
It was unnervingly quiet, no sound of movement beyond the bars.
I think they're gone for now.
I'm really thirsty.
I know, buddy. Me too.
Isn't there a water cooler behind the front desk?
I think so.
Maybe we could sneak out there, try to get...
Oh, I don't think that'd be such a hot idea, Benjamin, said a woman in the darkness on the other side of the bars. Teresa recoiled.
Who's there?
Don't you recognize my voice, honey? How could you not? You've been spilling your guts to me every fourth Thursday of the month for the last...
Pam? Oh, my God. What are you...
I heard you two screaming a few hours ago. Saw those Abbeys chase you into the sheriff's station. I waited until they left. I'm so relieved to find you both intact. You have no idea.
That was quick thinking, Teresa, locking yourself in here.
Teresa had expected some level of sight to return, but she still couldn't see her hand in front of her face. Pam said,
I'm not quite clear on what happened here last night. Did your husband show an Abbey to the town?
He told them the truth. About the Abbeys. The surveillance. That it's 2,000 years in the future. That we're all that's left.
So he really did it. That motherfucker.
Hey, don't look at me like that.
Teresa felt a cold knot ratcheting down in the small of her back.
It's pitch black in here, Teresa said.
Yes, it is. But I can see you, holding Benjamin in your arms and glaring into the dark in the general vicinity of where I'm sitting, and I don't appreciate
how...
They're called night vision goggles, Teresa, and this isn't the first time I've watched you through them.
What's she talking about, Mom?
Ben, don't...
Benjamin, I'm talking about the time I caught your mother and father sneaking out of your home on 6th Street after dark. That's strictly forbidden, you know.
Don't speak like that to my son.
Don't speak like that to the woman who's pointing a 12-gauge at you.
For a moment it was absolutely silent, Teresa trying to piece together the image, Pam sitting in front of their cell wearing night vision goggles and aiming a shotgun at her and Ben in the dark.
You're pointing a weapon at my son?
Teresa tried to ask it coolly, but her voice quivered, betraying the rage and the fear metastasizing inside of her.
I'm going to shoot him, too.
All the strength left her. Teresa climbed onto her knees and tried to shield Ben with her body.
Oh, please, Pam said. All I have to do, she moved, her voice moved, is stand up and walk over to this side of the cell. Then I have a clear shot again.
Why are you doing this? You're my shrink.
I was never your shrink.
What are you talking about?
It's truly a shame, Teresa. I liked you. I enjoyed our sessions together. I want you to know that what's getting ready to happen to you and your son isn't personal. You just have the misfortune of being married to the man who destroyed this town.
Ethan didn't destroy anything. He just told everyone the truth.
That wasn't his place. The truth can be a dangerous thing for the weak-minded.
You knew, didn't you? Teresa asked. All this time you knew.
What? The truth about Wayward Pines? Of course I knew. I helped build this town, Teresa. I was here from the beginning, day one. This place is the only home I ever had, and your husband ruined it. He ruined everything.
Ethan didn't open the gate. He didn't turn off the fence and let all these monsters inside. Your boss did that. My boss, David Pilcher, created this town. Every house, every road. He hand-picked each resident, each team member. Without him, you'd have been dead for centuries. How dare you question the man who gave you this life?
Pam, please. My son isn't responsible for any of this. You know that.
You don't understand, honey.
This isn't about holding you and Ben responsible for Ethan's actions. We're way past that.
Then what is it you want?
Teresa could feel tears coming, panic descending. Ben was already crying, shaking in her arms.
All I care about at this point is causing your husband pain.
Nothing more, Pam said.
If he's still alive, he'll eventually come here, looking for you, and do you know what he'll find?
You don't have to do this, Pam. The two of you dead, and me sitting here, waiting.
I want him to know I did this before I kill him.
Just listen. I am listening.
But before you start talking, ask yourself if you really believe you're going to change my mind.
Down the hall, somewhere in the lobby, Teresa heard the faintest sound, like a shard of glass splintering.
Most of this town was killed last night, Teresa said. I don't know how many of us are even left.
Another piece of glass crunched. Teresa raised her voice a notch.
But no matter how you feel toward my husband, how can you think that killing two of us who happened to survive is what's best for our species? We're on the verge of extinction.
Wow, that's a great point, Teresa. I hadn't thought of that.
Really?
No, I'm just kidding. I don't give a shit.
Pam racked a shell into the tube.
I promise I won't make you suffer. And honestly?
Take a second to look on the bright side. At least you two didn't die at the hands of an abbey.
This way, you won't feel a thing.
Well, you'll probably feel something, but it'll all be over before you know it.
He's a child,
Teresa cried.
Oh, would you mind sliding me the key to the cell before...
The muzzle flash brightened the entire room. The sound was deafening. Teresa thinking, we're dead, she did it. But she could still think. She could still feel her son in her arms. She braced for the pain to hit, but it didn't come. Someone was saying her name, and over the ringing in her ears, it sounded as if they were shouting from the bottom of a deep hole. Something sparked, a point of light flaring in her field of vision, Teresa wondering, is that the light at the end of the tunnel? Am I dead now, accelerating toward it? Is my son with me? It sparked again, only this time the light didn't die. It grew brighter and brighter until a single flame ignited a tiny bundle of dried-out moss. It was smoking now,
and she could smell the smoke as she watched hands lift the burning tinder off the floor. The flames illuminated the dirtiest face she'd ever seen, engulfed by a shaggy beard that must have taken years to grow. But those eyes. Even in the diminishing firelight, and through all the filth and the wildness in that face, she knew them. And not even the shock of almost dying could rival the shock of actually seeing them again. The man said in a raspy voice, "Teresa, my love." Teresa released Ben and lunged forward. As the light extinguished, she reached the bars and thrust her hands between them. She grabbed him, pulled him into the bars. Adam Hassler reeked like a man who had been in the wilderness for years, and as her hand slid inside his duster and wrapped around his waist, she could feel that he was skin and bones.
Adam?
It's me, Teresa.
Oh, my God!
I can't believe I'm actually touching you.
He kissed her through the bars. As Ben climbed off the bed and approached, he said,
I thought you were dead.
I should be dead, little man. I should have died 1,000 times over.
Ethan. He stood on the hood of Maggie's Jeep, staring out at the 150 faces that had gathered around him in the Ark. It felt strange to look at this entire group, which had for 14 years worked together to keep their fellow human beings, the residents of Wayward Pines, living in the dark. Ethan said, Last night I made a difficult choice. I told the residents of Wayward Pines the truth. I told them what year it was. I showed them an abbey. A voice in the midst of the crowd shouted, You had no right! Ethan ignored this. I'm guessing none of you agree with that decision, and that's not really much of a surprise to me. But let's see if you agree with the decision David Pilcher made in response. He killed the power to the fence and opened the gate. At least 500 abbeys entered the valley in the middle of the night. More than half of the town has been slaughtered. Those who managed to escape are stranded without food or water and with no heat since Pilcher has also cut off the power to the town. Disbelief spread quickly across the faces. Someone yelled, Liar! I understand that at some point in your lives before, each of you bought in hard to what David Pilcher was selling, and to be honest, he's a brilliant man. No one can deny that. No one can say he isn't a man of vision, and possibly the most ambitious person who ever lived. I understand what attracted you to him. It's a rush to keep company with someone who wields such power. Makes you feel better about yourself. From what I gather, a lot of you were at low points when David Pilcher came into your lives. He gave you purpose and meaning, and I totally get that. But he's as much of a monster as the abbeys who lived beyond the fence, maybe even more. The idea of Wayward Pines was always more important to him than the people who called that town home, and I'm sorry to say, it was more important than any of you. You all knew Elissa. Everything I've heard confirms that she was universally loved inside this mountain. She didn't see eye to eye with her father. She believed the people of Wayward Pines deserved better than 24/7 surveillance, than being forced to murder one another, than never knowing the truth. What I'm about to show you is upsetting, and I apologize for that. But you need to know what kind of man you served so you can begin to move past it. Ethan pointed behind the crowd at a 100-inch monitor mounted to the rock beside the glass door. Most days, it displayed work schedules. Who was on shift in surveillance, security, and suspension. Arrival and departure times for transportation going back and forth to Wayward Pines. An in-mountain message system for Pilcher's inner circle. Tonight, it would show David Pilcher, the creator of Wayward Pines, murdering his only daughter. Ethan shouted to one of Ted's surveillance techs, standing beneath the screen. Play it! Teresa. The smoke trailed up and vented outside through the barred window near the ceiling. Flames ate away at the legs of Belinda's desk chair, fueled by a ream of printer paper.
Ben sprawled on the single mattress, which Teresa had pulled off the metal frame and set next to the fire. She sat across from Hassler, holding her hands close to the heat. On the other side of the bars, Pam's body lay slumped across the concrete, the pool of blood still expanding around her head.
"I saw the fence was down," Hassler said. "I came racing into town. I went to our house, but you weren't there. I looked everywhere. I thought you and Ben were dead. As I was looking for ammo in the sheriff's station, I heard your voice, begging Pam to spare you. Isn't exactly the homecoming I imagined."
"I didn't imagine one at all," Teresa said. "I was told you weren't coming back."
"What happened here?"
"The town knows the truth now."
"Everything?"
"Everything. We lost a lot of people. I guess the man who built all of this decided to trash his playset and go home."
"Who told everyone the truth?"
"There was a fate called for Kate and Harold Ballinger, but instead of executing them, the sheriff used the opportunity to lift the curtain."
"Pope?"
"Pope's dead, Adam." Teresa hesitated. "A lot has happened since you've been gone. Ethan is the sheriff now."
"Ethan's here?"
"He was introduced into the town a month or so ago. He turned this place upside down. Nothing's been the same since."
Hassler stared into the flames.
"I didn't know he was here," he said.
"Why would you?"
"No, I just... Does Ethan know?"
"About us?"
"Yeah."
"No, I haven't told him. I mean, I was going to eventually, but Ben and I talked about it, decided there was no rush. We didn't think we'd ever see you again."
Tears dropped out of the corners of Hassler's eyes, carving clean trails through the grime embedded in his face. Ben watched him from the mattress.
"It's like a nightmare," Hassler said.
"What?"
"Coming home to this. Every day I was out beyond the fence, facing death and hunger and thirst. It was you, only you, that kept me going. The thought of how our life would be when I got back."
"Adam."
"That year we lived together."
"Please."
"Was the happiest I'd ever been. I love you. I never stopped."
Hassler crawled around the bed of coals and put his arm around her. He looked at Ben.
"I was a father to you, wasn't I?"
He looked at Teresa.
"And I was your man, your protector."
"I wouldn't have survived Wayward Pines without you, Adam, but I thought you were never coming back. And then, suddenly, out of nowhere, my husband is here."
Somewhere outside, an Abby howled. Hassler pulled his backpack over, opened it, dug around inside until he emerged with a leather-bound journal. Tearing off the plastic, he opened the weathered book to the first page. In the firelight, he pointed to the inscription. "When you come back, and you will come back, I'm gonna fuck you, soldier, like you just came home from war." It broke her to see those words. Knocked her flat. She'd written them just before Hassler had left.
"I read it every day," he said. "You have no idea the hard times it got me through."
She couldn't see now. The tears flowing, the emotion unfurling inside her like a hemorrhage, too fast to staunch.
"I'm not asking you to predict the future," he said. "I'm talking about right now, this moment. Do you still love me, Teresa?"
She looked up at the matted beard, the scarred face, his hollowed-out eyes.
God, but she did.
"I never stopped," she whispered.
The relief in his eyes was like a stay of execution.
"I need to know something," she said. "When we were living together, did you know?"
"Did I know what?"
"About this town. What it was. All the secrets that were kept."
He stared into her eyes and said,
"Until the day David Pilcher came to me and said I'd been chosen for a nomad mission beyond the fence, I only knew what you knew."
Why did he send you out there?
To explore. To search for signs of human life outside our valley.
Did you find any?
My last entry out there.
Hassler flipped to the end of his journal.
I wrote, I alone have the key to what will save us all. I'm literally the one man in the world who can save the world.
So what is it?
Teresa asked.
What's the key?
To make our peace.
With what?
With the fact that this is truly the end. The world belongs to the Abbeys now.
Even through her grief and shock, this statement registered. Teresa felt suddenly, completely, alone.
There isn't going to be some discovery that saves us, Hassler said, that puts us back on top of the food chain. This valley is the only place where we can survive. We're going to become extinct. That's simply a fact. Might as well do it with grace. Savor each day. Each moment.
Mustin. Mustin brushed the snow off the rocks and settled down into his perch. Due to the sheer quantity of ammo he'd brought along this time, it had taken him an extra hour to reach the peak. He'd scoped the town before, but of course, he'd never had a target in the valley. He zeroed out the scope on what was left of Sheriff Burke's Bronco. It took him 3 shots, followed by the 3 minor adjustments to the parallax, before he put a round exactly where he wanted it, through the front tire on the driver's side. The town had been laid out in regular blocks, 300 feet long on each side, which meant that further adjustments would be simple now that he had his point of reference. He cracked his neck. Grabbing the bolt, he opened the breech and jacked the first round out of the 5-capacity magazine. Settling in behind the focus, he enabled his headset as he glassed Main Street.
Mustin here. In position. Over.
Ethan Burke responded, We're at the tunnel door. Over.
Copy that. Beginning my first pass now. Stand by. Out.
There were bodies scattered up and down Main. 5 Abbeys feeding in the middle of the street in front of the steaming bean. For now, he ignored the forest and the cliffs surrounding the town and took his time studying the east-west running avenues, the north-south running streets. He scribbled a notation on his pad after every sighting. 11 minutes later, he tapped the talk function on his headset.
Mustin back. Over.
Go ahead, Ethan said.
I've got a visual on 105 aberrations. About half of them are moving in groups of between 15 and 20. The others are ranging solo through town. No sign of survivors yet.
Ethan said, You've got 20 minutes, and then we're rolling in. Over. Mustin smiled. A deadline. He liked that. He asked,
We taken bets? Over.
What are you talking about?
Number of kills? Over.
Just get to it. Mustin started on the south end of Main and worked slowly north. 15 hits, 5 misses, 12 kills. 3 left to wish they were dead, dragging themselves across the pavement. He moved up to 7th Street, made his adjustments, and went to work. Near the school, he sighted down a group of 18 Abbeys sleeping in the street. He shot 4 of them before the others woke up and realized they were under attack. Brought down 5 more as they scattered. It went on like this, and he had to admit it was the most fun he'd ever had with his AWM sniper rifle. With 5 minutes remaining, he shot 3 Abbeys on the road south of town, killed 2 more in the vicinity of the gardens. As the sheriff's voice came back over the headset, he put a round through the head of an Abbey running at full speed past the hospital.
Time's up, Ethan said. Over.
44, Mustin said. Over.
Excuse me? There are 44 less Abbeys to contend with. Over.
Impressive. Is the fence holding? Mustin swung the rifle south, glassing the forest in the vicinity of the fence. He reported,
The gate's still closed.
Now, I can give you some cover once you get into town, but shooting down into the forest is iffy at best. Over.
Understood. You'll be our eyes. Kill what you can. Tell us what's coming. Over.
Mustin reloaded the magazine and chambered the next round. He glassed what he could see of the woods and the boulders that surrounded the entrance to the superstructure.
You're clear to roll out, he said.
Ethan. He rode in the front passenger seat of an armored Humvee with Alan behind the wheel. In his side mirror, he could see the metal workers welding shut the entrance to the superstructure. Up on the roof of the Humvee, one of the guards manned a 50-caliber machine gun. There were two Dodge Ram pickup trucks behind them, two men standing in the back of the first with pump-action shotguns. The second Ram carried the chain gun. Two transfer trucks followed the Rams, and a third pickup truck brought up the rear, holding six guards in the bed, all armed to the teeth. In Ethan's headset, Mustin said,
I'd advise staying off Main. What's your route, over?
Alan turned out of the woods and onto the road into town.
13th to 5th, Ethan said. Then three blocks to the school. Any company?
See that guy in the distance?
Ethan squinted through the windshield. 100 yards up the road, an Abbey was squatting over the double yellow. The sound of approaching engines caught its attention, and as it stood, a puff of red mist exploded out of the side of its head.
You got a few other stragglers in your path, Mustin said. I'll start clearing the way, over.
The sun had yet to rise above the cliffs, and the valley ahead was still draped in the light of early morning.
Get any sleep? Alan asked. And what do you think?
Kate. She heard the tat-tat-tat of automatic gunfire. Everyone in the classroom did. She and Spitz went to work dragging the furniture away from the door and pulling the nails out of the frame. They got it open, told everyone to wait, rushed out into the hall, up the stairs, the noise of gunfire growing louder, and in the space between shots another sound becoming audible, the rumble of engines. At the exit, Kate raised her AR-15 and told Spitz to get the door. He pulled it open. She took two steps through the threshold. There were Abbeys in the schoolyard, running toward a convoy of vehicles in the intersection of 10th and 5th, a Humvee, three pickup trucks, and two 18-wheelers. An Abbey broke off from the pack and came hurtling toward her.
Spitz said, "You got him?"
She let it get closer, within 20 feet.
"Kate!"
She squeezed, put three bursts in a nice pattern through its chest, and dropped it 5 feet from the door. Now came a noise like thunder, and with it, from the second pickup truck, a bright orange muzzle flash from a gun so big it should have been mounted on an attack helicopter. It cut an entire row of Abbeys in half. The front passenger door of the Humvee swung open. When Ethan stepped out, her heart swelled. She watched him come around the front of the vehicle and run toward the fence. As he climbed over, four Abbeys charged him from the playground. Kate took aim and ripped through the rest of her magazine, bringing them all down. Ethan looked over, eyebrows up in surprise. For a moment, the shooting had stopped. There were Abbeys lying everywhere, and men climbing down out of the truck beds, beginning to set up a perimeter. Kate ran toward him, Ethan limping, carrying a shotgun, his jeans ripped all to hell, his shirt in tatters, face streaked with blood. Tears blurred her vision, and she wiped them away. They reached each other, and she threw her arms around him.
"How are the injured?" he asked.
"One died. One's hanging on. Barely. I brought trucks. We're taking everyone out of here, into the mountain." "Have you found Harold?"
"Not yet."
"What about Teresa and Ben?"
He shook his head.
Tears were running down her face, and her eyes were shut tight, and Ethan kept saying her name, kept saying that everything would be okay. But she couldn't stop crying, and she wouldn't let him go. Ethan. As he held Kate, he glimpsed a man walking down 10th Street in a long black duster that fell to